Chapter 19. 90% of England's road network had been abandoned in the PSP decade. The energy crunch put paid to most private travel, and the incendiary sun steadily deliquesced the tarmac to a worthless residue. A pre-warming-style maintenance program was out of the question, economically unfeasible, environmentally unsound. Motorways and critical link roads were kept open, but the rest was left to waste away. People who could afford cars bought them configured to cope with the rough terrain. The A47 was one of the roads the PSP was forced to refurbish. It was an essential transport artery between Peterborough and the A1, and the PSP desperately needed the goods which the city manufactured. It meant that the A47's traffic levels were high, and most of the vehicles commercial. Driving down it was a new experience for Eleanor. She began to realize how different England's city life had become from the pastoral existence of the countryside and smaller market towns. It was almost as though the country was developing a split personality. Of course, the gulf was more pronounced here than anywhere else. Peterborough struck her as a tripartite Babylon, the old, the new, and the waterbound, condemned by adverse circumstances to live with each other, rival siblings cooped up in the same house. It sat on the shore of the gigantic salt quagmire, which used to be the most fertile soil basin in all of Europe. The Lincolnshire Fens were originally marshes, drained over centuries to provide a rich black loam which could grow any crop imaginable. They were perfectly flat, like Holland. On clear days you could see for 40 or 50 kilometres over them. So some of Oakham's refugees had told her. The trouble was, the Fens' average height above sea level was 2 metres. In some places, like the Isle of Ely, they were actually below sea level. When the Antarctic ice melted, they never stood a chance. Peterborough absorbed nearly 2/3 of the population displaced by the rising water. The city had no choice. It was hemmed in between the new sludge to the east and a shabby band of tent towns on the high ground to the west. None of the refugees was going to move. They had lost their homes. They had found a functioning urban administration, and they were through with running. So they sat and waited for government to get off its arse and do something. The 3 attempts the PSP mounted to disperse them ended in riots, so the party was left with no choice. They poured money into permanent accommodation projects, as well as allowing in foreign investment to ease the load on the treasury, and as a result, it became one of the most prosperous cities in England. Huge housing estates mushroomed to serve vast industrial precincts, a crazy mismatch of development sprawling venomously over the Greenbelt. A deep water port was built above the drowned cathedral. Dredgers reopened the Nene, gouging out a new laser-straight channel directly into the Wash. Trade links, determination, and money, lots of money. That was the giddy synergy brew. Peterborough became England's Hong Kong, a unique city-state of refugees determined to carve themselves a new life. High on that special energy which crackles around fresh-start frontiers. Everybody was on the up-and-up, on the make, on the take. And if you couldn't find it in Peterborough, it didn't exist. A philosophy completely out of phase with the rest of the country's lethargy. The PSP City Hall apparatchiks just couldn't move fast enough to keep track of the construction chaos that boiled out from the suburbs. Half of the economy was underground, Eurofrancs only. Smuggling was rife. Spivs bought themselves penthouses in New Eastfield. A resurgent Gomorrah, her father had called it. Eleanor followed a big methane-powered articulated lorry down the gentle slope towards the bloated Ferry Meadows estuary, nay, park, the duo suspension thrumming smoothly on the tough, thermo-cured cellulose surface. The A47 turned left at the bottom of the slope, running along the top of a small embankment above the filthy, swirling water. After the lorry rumbled round the bend, she could see a string of 10 barges moored across the mile-wide estuary between the base of the embankment and Alton Winstow. Artificial islands of rock and concrete were rising beside each of them. She watched a crane swinging its load of rock from a barge across to the center of an island, dropping it with a low rumbling sound. A cloud of dust billowed up. When it cleared, she could see a gang of men swarming over the pile, rolling rocks down onto flat-topped carts so they could be packed behind the encircling wall of concrete. The idea for an eddy turbine barrage had been started back when the PSP was in power. They were generators that looked like propeller blades, mounted in narrow nacelles and tethered between the islands where the current spun them as it ebbed and flowed. Peterborough's post-warming industrial base had been founded on light engineering and gear production, easily served by the city's electricity allocation from the national commerce grid, and supplemented by solar panels. But the explosion of manufacturing had begun to attract heavier industries, pushing the power demand close to breaking point. Then, after the Second Restoration, the newly legitimized Event Horizon arrived. With its wholly modern industries, Peterborough was the obvious choice to supply the cyber factories with components once Philip Evans brought them ashore. The already vigorous city went into overdrive, but its expanded fortunes brought it up against infrastructure capacity limits. The eddy turbine barrage was intended to relieve the now chronic energy shortage, one of a dozen projects rushed into construction to cope with the excessive demands Event Horizon was placing. The traffic was snarled up in front of the duo. Eleanor slowed and saw a bus in front of the lorry had stopped to let out its passengers. They were all men in rough working clothes, carrying or wearing hard hats. They joined a group of about 70 waiting on the embankment below the road, level with the line of barges. There was a small jetty at the bottom of the embankment. A boat had just cast off, ferrying some of the men out to the islands. She could see a clump of men who'd been left behind on the jetty, arguing hotly with a pair of foremen. "They'll be lucky," Greg murmured as the duo drove past the crowd, milling aimlessly on the embankment.
"Why?"
"Tell you, the Eddy Turbine Barrage is a council project, right? Unless you're on the City Council Labour Register, there's no way you'll get to work on it."
"Well, why don't they sign on with the council, then?" she asked.
"A lot of people on the dole right now are ex-apparatchiks, and the new Conservative Inquisitors have got their hands full purging the administration staff of any that got left behind after the PSP fell. The government is nervy about them. What with inflation and the housing shortage, a few well-placed PSP leftovers could cause serious grief. So the last thing the council wants is to take them back, especially not on a project as important as this one."
"Why don't you apply to join the Inquisitors?" she teased. "That'd be a regular job."
Greg grinned.
"They couldn't afford me." He pointed ahead. "This is the turn. We'll park in Breton and walk the rest of the way."
She took a left through the old Milton Park Golf Club entrance. The duo powered along the rough cinder tracks lined by hemispherical apartment blocks that had sprung up to replace the greens, uses, and bunkers. The three-story buildings were self-contained Finnish prefabs, a burnished pewter for easy thermal control. Fast-growing myosopsis trees dominated the estate. Their long branches curved over the tracks, affording a decent amount of shade. There were small allotments ringing each of the silvery hemispheres, laid out with uniform precision.
"Tidy," she remarked, approvingly. "They've got a different attitude here."
"You're not being fair. Think what this will be like in 20 years' time. Just the same as Berrybutt."
"It might, then again it might not. These people are more in tune with the future. They believe in it."
They drove by a clump of mango trees in full fruit. She saw children playing around the trunks, seemingly immune to the ripe temptation dangling above their heads.
"Whatever happened to scrumping?"
"Do you want to move?" Greg asked.
"No," she grinned. "You couldn't live here."
They left the rustic eloquence of the Milton estate behind and slowed, slotting into the chain of vans and rick carts trundling through the grid maze of the Park Farm industrial precinct. It was made up of bleakly functional sugar cube factory units with coal-black solar collector roofs. Nearly half of them sported the Event Horizon Triangle and Flying V emblem, she saw. Most of the rest were overseas companies, some combinate logos. The foreign factories were anathema to the PSP, economic imperialism, but they had to let them in to pay off the massive investment loans which the Tokyo and Zurich finance cartels had made in Peterborough's new housing.
"Do you mean you would move if it wasn't for me?" Greg asked.
"Don't be silly."
She was still grinning. He looked like he had bitten something sickly.
"You don't have to come with me to see Royan, you know," he said. "It isn't exactly a picnic at the best of times. It'll only take me an hour or so."
"Oh, no," she said loudly. "You don't get out of it that easily, Greg Mandel. Do you realize I know practically nothing about the time between you leaving the army and meeting me? This is the first glimpse you've ever allowed me into this section of your life."
"You only had to ask."
She shot him a quick glance.
If you'd wanted me to know, you would have told me. And now you're starting to. I'm not sure what it means, but I'm bloody pleased.
He takes some getting used to, Greg offered. She recognized the tone, regret for the impulse decision to invite her.
Just how bad could his friend be? You said he was hurt.
Very badly. Completely disabled. And burned. It's not pretty.
I won't embarrass you, Greg.
I didn't imagine you would. Rather the reverse. My past is not totally savory.
Women?
No!
There were, she corrected demurely. That sort of knowledge isn't exactly hereditary.
He gave her a weak smile and gave up. Happier, though, she thought. However badly disfigured this Royan turned out to be, she was determined Greg would never be disappointed he'd introduced them.
The narrow streets and iron-red bricks of Breton were registering through the windscreen. She parked in an old schoolyard, next to an impressive new Conservative council banner, proclaiming its incipient refurbishment as the community's cultural centre. The classrooms were all boarded up, and someone had driven surveyor stakes through the playground. She got out and looked at him expectantly. He was wearing Levi's and his leather jacket over an olive-green T-shirt. She'd dressed in a shapeless navy blue sweatshirt and black jeans, nondescript, as he'd told her. Now she was beginning to realize why. Breton was a backwater, untouched by the vitality which roared through the rest of the city. The houses she could see all had heavy wooden shutters over the windows and solid metal security doors. Greg blipped the duo's lock. They were quickly surrounded by about 15 kids, none of them in their teens yet, silent, eyes shining bright out of grubby faces.
"Car watch, fella," piped a prepubescent voice.
"Highway robbery," Greg protested. The ritual was a relief in an obscure fashion, putting her back on solid ground. Breton was still plugged into the rest of the city, during the day at least.
£5, the lad said.
"I think we'll park in the next street," Greg retorted.
"4. It's very dirty,"
Eleanor pointed out. The kids put their heads together. She exchanged an amused glance with Greg.
"3, declared the summit. "And we wash it too."
"Half now?"
"2 now," said the highly affronted ringleader. He and Greg showed cards, both of them pictures of woe.
"Wonder what Walshaw will make of a £3 transport expense item," Greg mused whimsically, as the kids moved in on the duo, two racing away for water and sponges.
She let him guide her into the centre of Breton, pleased he was with her. The place looked rough. She would never have gone in by herself. The main street was roofed over by an erratic collage of plastic sheeting, solar cells, corrugated iron, even thatch, all supported by an equally bizarre collection of trusses, like telegraph poles and rusting chunks of electricity pylons. It was a twilight world where relief from the sun's heat was tempered by the clouds of arid dust any motion kicked up. The stalls snaking along the pavements lacked the cramped clutter of Oakham's disarray. Here the shops were coming back into use. There was a greater emphasis on material goods. Food was appearing in packages again, but no tins yet, she noticed. They grazed the stalls for stuff Greg said Royan would want. Junk, Eleanor thought. He picked out circuit boards, electric motors, inexplicable mechanical gizmos that were parts of bigger machines. Antique watches, the wind-up sort. 3 plastic carrier bags full, which came to £30. There was no logic behind it. He seemed delighted when he found a Sanyo VCR. It was lying among Mickey Mouse phones and kettles on a stall which was half lobster tanks, half broken gear. He haggled the owner down to a tenner and departed well pleased. She began to wonder about Royan again. Strange gifts. They walked out of Breton and into the Mucklands Wood Estate, and Eleanor decided that Breton wasn't so bad after all, not compared to this. The 15 high-rise blocks which had risen out of the dead forest were council-run low-cost housing. They represented the least successful aspect of the city's expansion program, a throwback to the worst of the 1960s style of instant slums. They were 20 stories high, identical in every respect, right down to the cheap, low-efficiency slate-grey solar cells clinging to every square centimetre of surface. Heat shimmer twisted the block's harsh geometry, blurring edges.
It was as though nature was trying to distort the inhuman ugliness which their desolate lines delineated. The ground between them was a wasteland. Less than half of the estate's intended employment workshops had been built, and those that the council had completed were abandoned, either burnt out or gutted. The Trinity's gang symbol was scrawled everywhere, brash and sharp, a closed fist gripping a thorn cross, blood dripping. She heard of the Trinities, even in the kibbutz, anti-PSP in a big way. Mucklands Wood could have been deserted. Nothing moved. Worse, there was no sound. There should have been something coming from those hundreds of grimed windows, music or shouting. Their footsteps crunched loudly on the badly rucked limestone path. She stuck close to Greg's side, eyes darting about nervously.
"Is this part of your past?" she asked.
"Briefly. I taught some of the people who live here."
"I never knew you were a teacher."
"Tell you, not your sort of teaching, school and such. I trained them in streetcraft."
"Streetcraft?"
"Techniques to break police ranks, ambush their snatch squads, how to counter the assault dogs, that kind of thing. It's a reversal of the counterinsurgency courses the army gave me."
"Oh."
You wanted to know, she told herself. Her eyes dropped to the crushed yellow stone fragments of the path. "Stay calm," Greg said quietly. She glanced at him, puzzled. His eyes had that distant look. He was using his gland. Then the Trinity's boy stepped out from his hiding place behind a crumbling employment workshop wall. He did it fast and smooth, simply there. And it was all she could do not to yelp in surprise. He fitted her image of an urban predator perfectly, almost a stereotype. Asian, somewhere in his mid-twenties, with hair cropped close, wearing a filthy denim jacket with the arms torn off, slashed t-shirt and tight leather trousers. Two bowie knives and a compact stun puncher were clipped onto his belt. There was some sort of gear plug in his left ear. A taut strap running round his neck held his throat mic. The Trinity's emblem was painted on his jacket. He leered at her, and she knew he could read her fright.
"What the fuck are you assholes? Hazard junkies?"
There were more Trinities spreading out of the ruins behind her and Greg, dressed in a grab bag of camouflage jackets, jeans and t-shirts, faces hard, carrying weapons ranging from knives up to things whose function she couldn't guess. They fanned out, forming a tight blockade.
"Cool it, mate,"
Greg said levelly and put a bag down, holding out his right hand, very slowly. The youth's sneer faded when he saw the Trinity's card Greg was holding.
"Where you get that?"
"Same place as you."
"No shit."
He pulled out his own card and showed it to the one in Greg's open palm. Confusion twisted his features as his card acknowledged Greg's authenticity.
"I don't know your face."
"I don't know yours," Greg said.
"Don't smart-ass me," he shouted.
"Greg's one of us, Des," a throaty female voice said from behind Eleanor. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a small figure with spiky mauve hair, wearing tourniquet-tight leopard-skin jeans and a sleeveless black singlet. The girl's age was indefinable, thin-faced. She could have been anywhere between 15 and 30. She was cradling a big Gauss pulse carbine casually across one arm. Bandolier straps crossed her flat chest, loaded with red-tipped slugs. Additional power magazines were clipped to her belt. Her face was one big smirk.
"Shut the fuck up, Susie," shouted the boy, confronting them. "Hear me? You could drive a fucking tank through that mouth of yours. This is my turf. I'm the man here. These bastards could be party."
Eleanor held on to Greg's forearm with her free hand, pinching. Suppose the card wasn't good enough. Greg grinned faintly.
"Hi, Susie."
The mauve-haired girl gave him an impish thumbs up. Des's face darkened.
"You know these?"
His forefinger jabbed at Greg.
"Sure," said Susie. "Greg's been Trinity from way back. Taught me all kinds of things."
Her eyes met Eleanor.
"Good too, isn't he?"
Eleanor kept her face perfectly blank, emotions frozen, just as they'd been for all those years in the kibbutz.
"Depends on the material he's got to work with, dear."
Not the greatest comeback in the world, but pretty bloody good, considering. Even Greg seemed vaguely surprised. Approving, too, she suspected. Susie started laughing.
So why the big reunion?
Des asked.
I'm here to see Sun, said Greg.
Christ, Des, let the man through.
Last fucking warning, Susie. I'll rip you good if you don't shove it.
Just ask Father, Greg said. He'll tell you my credit is good.
Yeah? So what about her? Des pointed at Eleanor. I don't see no card.
She's with me.
No shit.
Des, the man has our card that makes him one of us.
The new voice was deep. It didn't seem loud, but it carried to everyone. Authoritative, Eleanor decided. The Trinities were suddenly still and attentive. There was a hint of irritation in the voice, which she was very grateful wasn't directed at her. When she looked round, she saw a tall black man picking his way over the cracked concrete footings of a stillborn employment workshop. She thought he looked about the same age as Greg, moved the same way, too. Dangerous grace. Most of his 2-meter frame was muscle. He was wearing combat fatigues, clean, with knife-edge creases, a blue beret sporting a single silver star. She recognized it as an old-style British Army regimental insignia. Greg's memory cores at the chalet were full of military trivia like that.
Shit, yeah, Father, but... Des began.
But nothing. Man with a card is one of us, always. We don't all dress like crap, you got that?
Des's head lolled about like a moody nodding doll.
Sure, okay, Father. I just don't want to take no chances, you know.
The tension had evaporated from the other Trinities. Some of them grinned publicly at Des's squirming, led by Susie.
I know, boy. Now, is it going to happen again?
No, sir.
I don't hear you so good.
The big man's eyes flashed round the circle of Trinities.
No, sir,
they yelled gleefully.
Dismissed, he barked.
Susie flipped Greg a jaunty wave as the troop filtered away over the barren artificial moonscape. Greg and the black man were bear-hugging each other. Muscles slackened all over Eleanor's body in one convulsive shiver. She hadn't been aware how tightly wired she'd become. So many weapons, and not even Greg could have protected them if that animal Des had got it into his mind to shoot. Muckland's Wood was like nothing she'd heard of before, undiluted anarchy. The cold flush pricking her skin wouldn't abate now until she was back in the safe sanity of the duo, heading out. Greg and his friend released each other, both smiling broadly.
Man, you've been AWOL a long time. That's the way it goes,
Greg shrugged.
I can't afford to be seen with the likes of you nowadays. I'm a respectable professional now. Legitimate. Legitimate shit. Soft, that's what. Yeah. Teddy, meet Eleanor. Mate of mine.
Teddy's smile got wider as he swept her with an appraising gaze. Then he pulled his beret off in a gesture of hopeless gallantry.
Christ, officers did steal the best of everything.
He offered his hand and drew her knuckles to his lips. The ultimate stamp of approval. It cleared the air marvellously.
Bit jumpy, aren't they?
Greg said as the three of them walked towards the nearest tower.
Yeah, sorry about that, Teddy growled. We had us a chunk of extra parliamentary action against some party hacks 2 days back. Couple of my troops got hit. They're just keeping alert. Can't blame them for that.
You expecting some retaliation?
Greg asked. Teddy shrugged.
Dunno. The war isn't nearly over, Greg. There are tens of thousands of card carriers out there. Smart, well-organized, and tough with it. They'll do it to us all over again if we let them. Are the black shirts making any serious moves? No bullshitting, Greg. They are screwing this city. Almost as bad as we did. Trouble most nights. Police are stretched to the limit. Inquisitors can't seem to get on top of them. Black shirts have got Walton sewn up tight and hard. Nobody in, nobody out, unless they say so. We sit and eyeball each other over the A-15, and I keep pissing myself over what they're cooking up in there. Son watches what he can, of course, but even he's got limits. What I'd like is some spiral-armed MI-24s. Go in and beachhead the place. Flush the bastards out. Just like the good old days. This isn't the good old days, Teddy. We got rid of them, and they aren't coming back. The black shirts are just a bunch of zombies. Don't know they're dead yet. I know how to tell them. How many of them are in there now? Maybe 200 regular black shirts. 5 if they called in the hardliners they've got scattered about the country. But it's the rest who give me sleepless nights. Half of them still work in city chambers. If they get their act together, they could cause a lot of pain. This inflation is stirring people up, man. Lots of grumbling about the new conservatives. And you bet they've got it all planned out. Fucking party always loves plans. I can't fight that, Greg. This ain't physical, man. Physical I can handle. I gotta leave them to the new conservative inquisitors. More fucking bureaucrats. I tell you, it plain drives me nuts.
People won't fall for the PSP twice, Eleanor said. They're not that daft. Teddy smiled softly down at her.
Gal, I sure as shit hope you're right. Cause it ain't just here. Every town in the country is the same. Party ain't got the power no more. But that don't mean they don't want it again. Bad. But whichever way it tilts, we're ready for 'em. AKs loaded and Bibles to hand. You bet!
So how is Goldfinch, anyway?
Greg asked. Teddy rolled his eyes, sighing in despair.
Crazy as ever. Man, you should hear his sermons now. He's overloading on the vengeance routine. Hot for it he is, and slick with it. Keeps the kids in line, but good. They know they're fighting for what's right. Time just floats on by when he's in that pulpit. Even been getting civvies from Muckland's coming, too. You want to see him?
I'll pass. It's Royan I'm here for.
Thought so. See you're loaded up with his rubbish?
Two Trinities stood guard at the doors into the tower. They saluted smartly as Teddy walked by, never even giving Eleanor the eye. The hall belied the appearance of the building's external decay, clean and tidy, if somewhat Spartan. She thought she saw Greg wink at a tiny camera lens peeking out of the top of the doorframe.
I won't come up, said Teddy. Your app's probably big hush anyway.
Not from you, Greg said.
Thanks, man. Anything you need the Trinities for?
It isn't shaping up that way. But if it does?
We're here, Greg. Always here. Ain't got no place else to go. You come in and say goodbye before you go.
Right.
Teddy gave Eleanor another fast smile and disappeared into the old warden's flat. She got a blink of maps and screens on the wall, heavy-duty communication gear on boxy desks, and an enormous color print of Marilyn Monroe. The lift doors opened, and Eleanor leant heavily on the rear wall. She let out a hefty, relieved breath and gave Greg a hard stare.
Perhaps you were right about me not coming, she said.
Hey, I apologize about Des. I didn't know that was going to happen.
He punched for the top floor, and the lift began to hum upwards.
Maybe you did, but I should have. This estate, it saps hope. Breeds people like that.
You're wrong there. Muckland's Wood is one of the safest places to live in Peterborough.
She snorted disbelief.
Straight up, providing you're a resident. The Trinities don't tolerate theft and violence against their own.
Vigilantes.
Call them what you like. Just don't forget those troops are the ones who stood against the PSP's constables when the violence was at its worst.
I'm sorry, Greg. I didn't mean to knock them. I see how deep your involvement goes. And I am glad I came.
When my nerves calm down, I'll be able to express it better.
Tell you did all right out there. A lot of people would have run.
Me too, if I'd thought it would have done any good. Was Teddy being serious about the PSP still being active in Walton?
Sure.
Well, why doesn't the government do something?
Like what? We're living under a judicial system now. The rule of law is paramount. Being a member of a political party isn't an offence in this new fair England. Being in the Trinities, doing what they do, now that is a crime.
She shook her head in wonder.
It's all so wrong. Stupid.
Yeah. I know.